Hello and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. School board members rushed to pass a budget ahead of the looming deadline and mounting pressure from lawmakers. And you may have seen his work on the show The Bear without even realizing it. We sit down with Michelin-starred chef Curtis Duffy to talk about the hit show and his new memoir. First off tonight, local union leaders are preparing for a rally and march on Labor Day. A coalition of groups, including the Chicago Federation of Labor and the Chicago Teachers Union, announced Monday's demonstration called Workers Over Billionaires. Organizers say the purpose of the rally is to push back on the Trump administration's actions, cutting Medicaid and stripping union contracts for thousands of federal workers. Monday's march and rally will take place from 11 to 1 p.m. at the Haymarket Memorial in the West Loop. That announcement comes as President Trump is threatening to send the National Guard to Chicago. Trump has said the move would be to address crime in the city, despite violent crime being down more than 20% in Chicago so far this year. Shootings and homicides are also down more than 30%. Local anti-violence groups today are calling out the president for making cuts to federal violence prevention grants.
If the administration cared about public safety, they would not have slashed $158 million in violence prevention programming, federal funds. They would not have, on day one, shut down the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention. Okay, so it is not about safety. It is about intimidation and control.
Starting today, the stories of those who survived the Holocaust and other genocides across the world are being told through a moving new holographic exhibit in downtown Chicago.
I speak because the Holocaust stopped, but the hatred in the world has not stopped. And hatred is such a useless emotion. I think if you lead with love, you get a lot further.
One of those survivors is Rhody Glass, who shares her family's story of surviving the Nazi occupation of Amsterdam. It's part of the year-long exhibit Experience 360 at 360 North State Street. It is the first satellite branch of the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center in Skokie, which is currently under renovation. Visitors will wear headsets for a 360-degree experience, hearing Glass's story, as well as those of Rwandan and Guatemalan genocide survivors. For more information, please check out our website. Up next, we sit down with some CPS school board members to talk budget pressures.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
The Chicago Board of Education is facing a looming deadline on the district's budget. Board members have to come to a consensus by Friday or face being in violation of state law. The issue, not everyone on the board is on board. 11 members recently signed a letter knocking the current budget proposal for not including an option to take out a loan to cover the cost of the municipal pension payment. While the plan touts keeping cuts out of the classroom, there are concerns about long-term financial stability. Joining us now are Jennifer Custer, a CPS board member representing District 1B. That includes neighborhoods like Irving Park and Portage Park. And CPS board member Angel Gutierrez, who represents District 8A, which includes neighborhoods like West Lawn and Garfield Ridge. Welcome to Chicago Tonight. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Brandis.
Thank you for
having us. So, as mentioned, CPS leaders say that the budget protects classrooms even with that $126 million in cuts to central office staff, IT projects. Jenny, do you think the proposal cuts will really steer clear of students in classrooms?
I do. I think that the budget that we've been presented protects kids, protects classrooms, and protects the financial future of the district. And I think those that oppose this budget are really threatening to potentially shut down the district, but also they're threatening the financial well-being of the district in years to come.
Both of you have expressed opposition to paying into the municipal pension this year. Angel, why is deferring that payment? Why do you think that's the best choice for CPS right now?
So, you know, if you think of the budget as a whole, right, it's balanced, it's responsible, it's community driven. And our ability to have to pay that payment now will take $175 million out of the classroom, because somehow, some way, we will have to pay for that. We'll have to take some of the savings out of the classrooms. And we can't have that.
Do you feel like the organization has really been cut as much as it can within an inch of the classroom, basically, just enough to stay away from classrooms? And after, if you had to spend that $175 million from the CPS budget, that's where we'd see the hit.
It will. It will take dollars away from the classroom. That will mean teachers, that will mean aides, that will mean some of our
programming
that we're doing in the schools as well. So
critics argue that deferring this payment, it only kicks the can down the road. How do you respond to concerns that this only deepens the district's long-term financial instability and postponing the inevitable?
I mean, I think that paying this payment is nothing more than helping the mayor fix his own budget gap. I mean, the state law says that this is a payment that the city makes. This is not a payment that the district makes. And all this really is fixing his budget problem. And we, as the governing body of the Board of Chicago, the School Board of Chicago, our job is to make sure that we're making the best decisions for the district as a whole moving forward. And state law precludes us from making that payment.
So last week, your colleagues, Makayla Blaze and G2 Brown, they joined us. And Blaze had a bit of a different view. Here's what she said.
The entire MEABF pension payment is $1 billion. Half of that is CPS employees, so we'd say roughly $500 million should be our portion. And the city's only asking for us to put in $175 million, which they're giving us in TIF. So if you look at it comprehensively, we still end up on the plus side, and we also have skin in the game, and we're taking care of our employees.
Angel, what's your reaction to that perspective?
So, you know, it's interesting hearing that clip. I think that us moving forward as a board, as we begin to look at what disentanglement looks like from the city of Chicago, all those things will have to be at the table. I think in this current budget cycle, I would challenge the education mayor to stop trying to shake down the district and take dollars out of the classroom to help fund his particular problems.
So the plan, it counts on nearly $379 million in TIF revenue. And Angel, you've argued that that's money that's already owed to the district, right? Because it's already factored into the district's budget. Is TIF, is that a reliable fix or short-term patch for the district?
I think it's a combination. I think, right? When you earn those dollars, they're gone, right? Until the expiration of the tax increment financing
district
right? So it's a double-edged sword. But in every year, over the course of the last 10 years, there's been a declaration of surplus in the TIF. And roughly, I think there's $3.1 billion in that TIF. And I'll give you a $1 billion reason why. The mayor has to declare a TIF because he's got $1 billion worth of problems.
Almost literally.
Yeah.
as far as like the size of the budget.
Budget.
The gap
deficit,
that is, yes. Mm-hmm. Jenny, you've also supported using TIF. How do you respond when critics say that, you know, using TIF only makes the district more vulnerable year after year?
You know, I do think it is kind of a short-term fix, right? I think what our job is here on this board, what we are tasked to do is we're tasked to set up the district for financial stability moving forward. And sometimes, yes, it does require some really hard moves like we've had to make this year. Nobody wants to make any cuts anywhere to the district. We don't want to do that, but we might have to make some of those moving forward if we want to put the district in financial stability. And the fact of the matter is, changing this budget in any way threatens that financial stability moving forward, and it's our job to make sure that we're keeping it as healthy as possible so that we're not constantly coming back to the discussion about whether or not we're going to have TIF surplus to make it over the finish line.
So the plan does not include new borrowing. Both of you have been opposed to taking out a massive loan to cover the district's finances. And so if accruing new debt is off the table, Jenny, I'll come to you with this. What realistic alternatives does CPS have to maintain stability?
Yeah, we have to look at some structural changes. We have to look at all of our spending. What are we spending it on? How is it affecting the students in our classroom? What are the outcomes of that spending? And we need to take a really good hard look at some of that and have some really honest conversations. And you know, we began this process already with this budget by going out to the community, talking to them about some of the issues, asking them what their thoughts are, how they feel about things, and they gave us some of that feedback already. And those are things that I think we need to continue to do, is engage our communities and engage that conversation about what we do moving forward as a district.
And I think the reason that we are against that borrow is because we've seen what it's done in 2016 to 2018, right? $200 million loan then is the equivalent of 2,000 teachers' jobs. So think about that. That would put us almost out of business as a district, and we can't have that.
So some state legislators, Representative Curtis Tarver in particular, have suggested that more state funding should come along with more oversight and reform. Here's a little bit of what he had to say on our show earlier this month.
But I do think there still needs to be a role for the state to implement some reform if we're going to send those funds to CPS.
What do the two of you make of that? Should any additional funding from the state, mind you, the state has said repeatedly they don't have money for CPS, but should any additional funding come with ties, basically, to show that there are reforms or improvements?
I think before that conversation even starts, we need to talk about how charity begins at home. I mean, every state representative that I've talked to, every legislator that I've spoken with is looking for us to make these hard decisions to set the district off on the right path before we come asking and knocking at the door for more funding and more things like this. So I think charity begins at home. I think we need to start having some of these really difficult conversations and start making some of these difficult choices and setting the district up for a stronger financial future. And then when we've made some good progress, we should start working with our state legislators and we should start talking about how do we do better and how do we advocate for more.
Both of you voted no for interim CEO Macklin King, who was, of course, backed by the mayor. But since then, Angel, you've said that, you know, she's actually changed your mind. You've been pleasantly surprised by her leadership. What is it that she's done or said to win you over?
You know, I think she's pretty even keel, and she has really, everything she said she was going to do, she's kept her word. And I think that goes a long way in a leader. She wanted to do these community gatherings to gather the information. Yes. And what did the gathering show? Overwhelmingly, that residents and parents wanted to keep no cuts to the classroom. They wanted to make sure that we didn't take on any additional revenue. And
borrowing.
Three, that we didn't pay that payment unless there was additional dollars, right? And those are the same things that the former superintendent told
Pedro
the district
Martinez,
back then.
Yes, who, of course, was fired by your predecessors.
Mm-hmm.
Jenny, what happens if you all don't agree on a budget by Friday?
That is the big question. If we don't agree on a budget by Friday, the district spending authority ends per our resolution passed in June. And if we do not agree, if we cannot come up with a balanced budget, and if we cannot pass a budget, we are potentially looking at a district-wide shutdown until the time when we can successfully pass one.
10 seconds left. What do you think the likelihood of that is? Do you go into Thursday's meeting with full faith that you all will be able to get this done?
I trust and hope that my colleagues will understand the gravity of this situation and will understand at the end of the day what this means for the children in the classrooms and the families across the city of Chicago who send their kids to these schools and entrust us with them. So I'm hoping for a good outcome.
We'll be watching. Jenny Custer, Angel Gutierrez, thanks to you both. Good luck on Thursday.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we're back with more right after this. Foodies, this one's for you. Decorated chef Curtis Duffy has become a household name, making his mark on Chicago's dining table for the past 25 years. Now he's sharing a little more than fine dining. His new book, Fireproof, Memoir of a Chef, outlines his rise to success and dives even deeper into challenging and traumatic events he faced throughout his childhood. And joining us now is James Beard Award-winning, Michelin-starred chef Curtis Duffy, chef and owner of Ever Restaurant. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you. Nice to see you again.
Congrats on all the things.
Thank you so much.
And the book, of course. Yes. Yes. So your documentary, For Grace, came out back in 2015, and it told a lot of your personal story then. Why did you want to write a book now, too?
That's a great question. You know, when we started writing the book, Jeremy, the co-writer, also asked, like, the same question. Why? You're so young. You're 45. Why now? And for me, you know, it is the transformation through adversity, and I felt it was time for me to tell my story. Like you said, Grace just skimmed the surface a little bit, and I had a lot more stories that I needed to get out, wanted to get out, and what a better way than to put it on paper.
Did it feel somewhat therapeutic?
Yeah, very much so. Every story led to something new, a new discovery, something that I had put away for many years, kind of shuffled under the carpet, if you will, as we all do. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was very therapeutic in that sense.
You mentioned your co-writer, Jeremy Wagner, and in reading the book, the writing's very clever. Did he sort of master your voice because he knows you that well?
Yeah.
Do you talk like that?
Yeah, you know, because we were friends before, right? So that made the story, for me, allowed me to kind of be okay with letting some of it go, right? I think the big part of writing this memoir was the comfortability to allow those stories to come out into somebody that I trusted dearly. And I felt like if we would have wrote this book with somebody else, maybe the stories wouldn't have been as harsh and as brutally honest as we once set out to do, was to make sure that we're telling the story with the utmost truth and being brutally honest and not sugarcoat anything.
You share a lot about your difficult childhood, living mostly in poverty, sleeping in your parents' closet because the apartment at the time was too small. The time your father held a shotgun to your head to force you to fire your own shotgun as a kid, fights and violence frequently. Yet you still dedicate the book to your father, Robert Duffy, Bear, and your mother, Jan, your stepmother, who you came to call mom. How are you still able to see the humanity in your father when maybe others didn't throughout his life?
Something Jeremy and I spoke about was making sure that the book didn't villainize my father. And I was very adamant about that. You know, I had spent 30 years, it's 30 years now since their passing. I spent 30 years of my life understanding and trying to understand his mentality and the way he operated and the way he did things and why he did things a certain way. For me, it was a long process of forgiveness, and you know, they are my parents, and they've given me a tremendous amount outside of, you know, the things that how we grew up. They gave me a tremendous amount of great things as well. So you know, I'm always blessed that, you know, I had a certain amount of time and they were present in my life, and I'm always going to be thankful for that.
Of course, one of the biggest traumatic moments that you had to overcome was, of course, when your father killed your mother and then himself in a murder-suicide after a 10-hour standoff with police. You were 19 years old at the time when you had to identify them. Out of all the tough moments in your childhood, how did that one shape you?
Well, wow. I mean, it was in an instant, right? It changed my life forever. So everything that I knew leading up to that kind of all just disappeared. And I had to kind of just put it away and decide for myself, how am I going to move forward? And what am I going to take from it? How am I going to learn from it and move forward? And I think we all do that in life, is we have that option to take the good and the bad, and we can choose left or right. And for me, like, I wanted to take that portion of it and dedicate it towards my craft, which happened to be cooking at the time. And that's all I wanted to do. And that kind of just forced me and put blinders on and just try to achieve something great.
You also, you share the letters that your father wrote in those last very dark months in this book, which is something deeply personal, of course, for you, for your family, for him, certainly. Why did you want to share those here?
It's part of the story, right? I mean, it's like we said, it's I wanted to be an open book. I wanted this to be my entire story. So I didn't want to pick and choose, like, all these fluff pieces and make this, like, this beautiful book. I wanted it to be what it is. I wanted to tell my story, and that is part of the story. So why not put them in the book, you know?
What do you hope other people take from this particular chapter of your life, of the book?
I think inspiration. I want people to know that, you know, everybody has a story. I'm lucky enough to be able to have a platform to have a voice of my story, but we all know everybody goes through things, and, you know, if they can take a little bit from the book and if it helps them in a direction dealing with something currently, dealing with something in the past, then that's a win for us. That's a win for me.
You never got to cook for your parents, certainly not at the level. You mentioned, you know, cooking for them when you were still learning and testing some stuff out, and maybe they were being nice because it wasn't that good.
For sure.
At the level that you cook today, though, what would you make for them?
For me, it wouldn't even be about cooking at this point. It would be just about the idea of sitting at a table together with them, with my family, my immediate family, my wife and children, and them, to have us sit and have a meal and have conversation. And I don't know what I would cook. Sorry.
I'm sure you'd figure it out at some point.
Yeah.
Okay, so pivoting a bit, because we know that, you know, during home ec is when you find cooking, and you've got some teachers and some mentors who, I'm trying to fast forward here, some teachers and some mentors who get you on your way. Now, of course, you are chef and owner at Ever and your cocktail lounge after next door. So you and your restaurant, you play some quiet but critical roles in that little show called The Bear. Your hands are in several important food plating scenes. Both the restaurant and the cocktail lounge play the role of kitchen.
Yes.
What did it mean for you and your businesses to play those parts in a show that became wildly successful?
Yeah, it was so important because it's a show that really gets it. It's a show that really, what I really love about it also, it shows so much of our city in such a great light. And I know there's a lot of films that get shot here in the city, but this one does magical things for our city, and to be a part of that was incredible. You know, the team was incredible, the cast was incredible, and they tell a story that really nails it. I mean, the kitchen life there that they do portray is about 90% accurate. You know, they do a really good job with it.
Has anybody recognized your hands from the show?
I think with the black nails, it's pretty easy to pick out for sure.
Yeah. Can you relate to the main character, Carmi, in that program and what he and his team are going through, like getting a restaurant off the ground and running it every night, trying to be successful?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. I mean, that is the daily grind with us, right? It is. We have a deadline every day at 5 o'clock when we open those doors, and we have those pressures leading up to 5 o'clock. And then once the doors open, here we are. Now we have 60 guests that we have to please and hit their expectations and make sure that they're leaving incredibly honored that they were there, and incredibly thankful and happy when they walk out the front door. And that's our job every single night that we're open.
Yeah. And a lot goes into the work that you all do, learning about those guests before they even show up.
100%. Yeah, we try. We do Google, we do LinkedIn, we do Instagram. We try to find as much as we can to make your experience better. We're going to try to find as much as we possibly can. If you're left-handed, we're going to make sure your silverware is on your left side. If you drink Coca-Cola in a lot of your pictures, we're going to make sure we have that product in-house.
You talk about the, you know, some of the people that you worked under, of course, Charlie Trotter, Grant Achatz at Alinea, John Souza. Big lessons you learned from them. What's your advice to future chefs?
Well, I think taking a little bit from each one of them is what made me successful. It's understanding their successes and taking what is available to you and what you can apply on your daily, every day during
your journey.
Exactly, yep. Right? So what I take from John was certain things, what I've taken from Charlie was certain things, and Grant, all of those had great attributes to who I am today.
30 seconds left. The book is called Fireproof. What does being fireproof mean to you?
It means being resilient. It means, you know, building character through adversity. It's everything to me. It's me coming up through what I came up and coming out on the other side and untouched and being able to continue to push forward.
All right. Congratulations, Curtis Duffy. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Again, the book is called Fireproof, Memoir of a Chef. You can read an excerpt on our website. And that's our show for this Tuesday night. Stay connected with our reporters and what they're working on by following us on Instagram at WTTW Chicago. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul on the legal debate on President Trump's plans to deploy the National Guard in Chicago. And from job training to legal support, we take a look at the services being provided at a new workforce hub in the Austin neighborhood. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that contributes to public safety policy and guidelines.